and welcome to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep minute by minute into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I'm one of your hosts, John.
And I'm Zach.
And we are joined by a very special guest this week, Dune Navigator Martin. How are you doing, man?
Hello, everyone. I'm very excited. Obviously, the people listening can't see me, but I've been giggling and smiling the whole way through. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, we are very, very happy to have you on. We've done a lot of interaction and everything on Blue Sky, but this is our first time actually like sitting down and talking about Dune. And boy, do we have a week of minutes to talk about.
Indeed.
At least five of them.
Yeah. You know, there could be five. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a pleasure to have you here, man. We've always been very impressed with the stuff you've put together, and just your level of nerddom, I think, far surpasses both of ours. But
I certainly appreciate that. But I feel like, especially on Friday, that the hype train went away. But you guys, like, I don't know if I can live up to the expectations. I'll try, but I don't know if I can.
All right. Well, let's get into it. We are, of course, talking about minute 115 through 116 of Dune Part 2. John, will you tell us where we left off?
So last week we were left off with Jessica and Chani and Stilgar all looking over Paul's knocked out ass body. Mm-hmm. And he's not doing great right now. He had taken the Water of Life. And as we've been told throughout the movie, no man can take the Water of Life. They will die.
A little sexist, but okay.
Yeah. Well, in this case, Paul is not dead. We start this minute off with a pickup where we left off last week with a hell of a cliffhanger saying his vital signs are so low they can't be detected, but he is alive.
Okay, so this is Jessica pulling out her Prana Bindu magic stuff just to be able to see. She can tell that he is alive, but no one else can.
She telemedicines him from across the room.
Well, it's interesting, I think, from I'll be stealing some of the book notes maybe, but what's interesting from pure lore perspective is that in the books Jessica doesn't know what's wrong with Paul, and that's kind of like a great deviation, and I feel like also a bit of a plot hole. Because with all that Prana Bindu stuff, she divines that he's alive, despite kind of everyone else wanting to take his water for the tribe at this point. But she doesn't she doesn't know what's wrong with him.
That's one thing that I was not upset about, because I understand why they made the change, but it was a little surprising to me that they took the part out where, yeah, people were like, he's dead, get him out of here, we need his water, we just had, you know, one, our sieges are getting raided, we need this shit, and she's like, you know, holding them back.
It was certainly one of your peeves from last week.
It was, yeah.
And it, like, from a movie perspective, I can understand, because obviously, you know, a couple of minutes ago, she told the Maker Keeper that there's going to be a man coming who's going to try the Water of Life.
Yeah.
So obviously movie Jessica would have expected this, but book Jessica has no idea what's happening, and no one else does either. Like, no one in the siege knows that Paul took the Water of Life.
Right. They're doing what feels like some time compression here as well. Because in the books, it's like a couple of weeks that he's been knocked out.
3 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, we don't really get any indication that it's been a long time since he's done this.
It seems like it's only been a couple hours just because...
I think so too. Yeah, that's my sense as well.
Yeah, there was the whole thing where, like, immediately after Paul takes the Water of Life, we get that hard cut to Jessica and her Fedaiken bodyguard, you know, being escorted in by the Maker Keeper. Jessica's like, who else knows of this? And the Maker Keeper says no one. So it has to be recent. So
yeah.
Unless the Maker Keeper has been able to keep people out of the temple and also keep a pretty big secret for a very long time. But
well, all she has to do is just move the Water of Life, you know, decanter away from him. Like, she doesn't need to do much to keep the secret.
Right.
There's just a body on the ground, and she just has to, you know, not allow anyone to take his water.
Yeah. I mean, she could explain it away in any manner of ways. I mean, we saw her, like, stance in the sand pit. She looks like she could beat the shit out of somebody.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, totally. bragging rights right there. Like, exactly. this guy beat Jameis. Hey, sorry, Jameis.
Jameis. So Stilgar is looking on in the face that I think he's going to keep for most of this week, which is just anticipation and worry and wonderment. He's looking real worried right now. And Chani looks up real angrily at Jessica and says, "What did you do to him?"
And I just love, there's no response. She just gives the Rebecca Ferguson stare. Yeah.
Jesus, if anything, I want that frame from the IMAX. Like, that is the frame that I want. You said what, bitch? What? Yeah.
I might have to go back and adjust the thumbnail for this episode to be that one.
Maybe. She just like gives her this knowing look. She's like, "I didn't fucking do anything. Come on. What are you doing?"
But also, why, like, this might be kind of an internal plot hole for me in the movie, except if you can kind of headcanon in a way. But why does Chani assume it was Jessica? Like, she came in, she didn't even say hello to her, she ran past her, left Stilgar trying to come out of the ornithopter.
A wounded ran Stilgar in, still.
Yeah. Saw Paul's body on the ground and a couple of praying people around. Like, she has no idea what happened. At least, I would assume she has no idea what happened. So why the animosity? Like, even within the movie, I don't understand the animosity, because Jessica, for most of this time, has been south, you know, kind of fanning the flames. Mm-hmm. And she was up north fighting with Paul. So they lit, like, what, they exchanged angry emails? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I read it as a Chani knows that Jessica is trying to get Paul to, you know, go down this Kwisatz-Haderach path.
Mm. Sure.
And she's, which is, that's much less of a secret in the movies than it is in the books. And she is just worried that Jessica did something to progress that, you know, to make progression in that. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think she's off base with immediately accusing Jessica, or at least in the context of the movie, she's not off base. But it is a very strange, like, if you're not putting those pieces together, it could be a jarring statement.
But also, like, just to kind of, another argument for this in my mind is, in the books, and I know you talked about this last week, but in the books, Jessica's the one who sends for Chani to come to, I think, the Cave of Birds.
I sent for you, but I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like, she has this, and again, feels like a bit of a plot hole within the book, because she just says, like, "Oh, instinctively, I felt like it would be a good decision if you're around."
Right.
But it's Jessica who sends for Chani, and I don't think it's explained how the others, quote unquote, and Chani gets to know about the situation and comes to the Maker Temple. But I would assume the same happened here, that, you know, Jessica sent out for everyone to come.
Yeah.
So again, if Jessica did something to Paul, why would she send for Chani? I don't know. It just feels off for me.
Yeah. And Chani's just, I mean, she's seeing her, you know, partner laid up on the ground here. She's panicking. She's just reaching out. And maybe it's the explanation is as simple as she's lashing out because she's in panic right now.
Yeah. Might be.
I want to say it was around minute 30 was when there was the whole, "What are you guys talking about?" scene where, like, Paul was trying to like get his way into, you know, Chani and Shishkali's group and everything.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. Pour one out. And
sorry to stop you here, but that shish kebab joke, perfect joke, like from last week. I'm so happy you didn't cut it out. Perfect.
Thank you.
During all that time, there was the conversation of, you know, what are they going to do to her in there, where Paul's asking, you know, what's happening to his mom. And Shishkali is like, she's going to drink worm piss, the water of life, yada, yada, yada. But there has always been like that lingering possibility, you know, I think in Chani's mind, that Paul would also take the water of life. even though she wasn't there for when Jessica in recovery was telling Paul, you have to take the water of life. You have to take it. Your mind's going to open. You're going to see the beauty and the horror.
Jessica's first crash out of this movie.
Yeah. the most stressica as yes. It was.
No, but like Paul might have told Chani about, hey, my mom was super crazy after the drink. Like, Jesus.
Yeah. Well, it would also stand to reason that Paul, you know, in the interim may have told her, like, she wants me to drink the water of life. So, you know, that's also a possibility. Mm-hmm. And I think if Chani, like, shows up in the room and she sees that Paul's vital signs are practically non-existent, but he is somehow still barely alive. Like, it's not an unreasonable jump to assume that he had drank the water of life. Also, considering that the decanter is right there next to him on the floor, too. So, you know, there is also that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but still, like, for me, the weird thing is, if you look at it from kind of Chani's perspective, there was the 10 worm group writing session mm-hmm. where Paul decided to beeline it to the left. I assume they talked about what's going to happen. Like, they all of them headed south, and except for Paul, who decided to go a different direction.
Yeah.
In my mind, that's something that the two of them discussed, that, oh, he needs to do something to whatever. So kind of feels weird to take away his agency and then put it on mom. But I completely mm-hmm. agree with you about lashing out, and it's a stressful situation. And
yeah.
Then again, I have my whole like separate notes on how this is very much contrary to Book Chani, who's level-headed and, oh, this is a, you know, crisis. We need to fix mm-hmm. this. And she goes into problem-solving mode.
Yeah, I mean, you could fill an entire book about the differences between Book Chani and Book Chani.
Certainly an entire podcast.
Certainly an entire podcast, yep. So, Stilgar, and he's kind of moved from anticipation to almost like religious fervor here.
Not like religious fervor. This is okay, his,
this is
like,
official.
Yeah. This is Stilgar's Super Bowl. Sorry, Stilgar's big game.
Big game, yes, thank you. We can't legally say that, the name of that football game. So he is, in Chukopsa, he is saying, because he is the one, Lisan al-Ghaib should find his way.
I think before that happened, sorry, Chani's down on her knees, kind of close to Paul's face, mm-hmm. and she's saying, not that, why would he do that?
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
Are you saying the decanter was visibly close to him? Because my notes are like, do what? Like, what does she think he did?
It's obviously he's at the maker temple. Next to him.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
You know, okay. They've been pretty good in these movies of keeping to the show don't tell, kind of
with a couple of very notable exceptions.
Yeah, and this is one of them. They need you to understand exactly what has happened right here. So all the pieces are in the frame. They're like, hey, just so there's zero confusion, he drank that shit, and now he's dying. Maybe Jessica did it. Who knows? We'll find out next time.
But then that's so weird about Jessica asking the maker keeper about who else knows. Oh, no one, just you. And yeah. Then the decanter is left next to him. Like, oh, everyone knows at this point because they put two and two together.
Yeah. And then didn't we say last week there was already a group of people outside the
praying there?
Yeah. So there were a group of pilgrims outside, but there's never an explanation as to why they're there. They could just be there, you know, on like a pilgrimage
scheduled a scheduled tour of the temple.
I think we said Hootie and the Blowfish concert was in town.
So many bucket hats. But okay, so with all the people inside at this point, like, you also have to understand, we don't know how long it's been since Jessica used her unnecessary voice to tell her one bodyguard true. To go find Chani and Stilgar and, you know, the rest and
the others.
Yeah. So she may have, you know, once she got the situation and everything under control, just been like, all right, yeah, you can come in, but don't fucking get close to him or whatever. Right. I don't know. It's a weird, like, when you're looking at book versus movie in this whole sequence, because you would think that she would want to keep everyone away from Paul to protect his water, but
like that's what happens in the books as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
I think she even goes so far as to start a rumor with the Fedaiken about Paul being in a holy trance preparing for the last battle. And the Fedaiken go out and spread that rumor and everyone's, oh, okay, then we don't take his water. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But in that case, my other note on that was, because I know you always have book notes and Art of the...
Art and Soul. Yeah.
Art and Soul, thank you.
Yep.
Art and Soul notes. So I thought, what else could I bring? And I wanted to bring kind of comparison notes to the 2000 sci-fi miniseries.
Okay.
So I tried to do a beat-by-beat kind of comparison. The only problem is that the 2000 sci-fi miniseries is very close to the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to the point where they take dialogue the pages.
I call it perfect.
Yeah. And so my only note to this scene is, in the 2000 sci-fi miniseries, Paul is laid down on kind of a bad mattress situation, and he has, I kid you not, I hope you're sitting down, 10 glow globes around him. 10.
Fuck yeah! I love the glow globes in the sci-fi miniseries too, because they're just like...
tumbleweeds you have to shake.
Just tumbleweeds you gotta shake.
That's awesome. It's perfect. It fits the environment. They're great.
Yeah.
So not to dunk on the Denis Villeneuve movies, but no 10 glow globes around him. Not a single one. So sad.
They're really not getting a lot of screen time this movie.
Well, hold on. We're still due for another glow globe in a couple weeks. Chill out.
Thank you. We get one every couple of weeks. Awesome. Great.
No, we don't have 10 glow globes around us though.
The final note on this is, and again, kind of coming back to the sci-fi miniseries as well, is that I definitely applaud the fact that Zendaya has finally something else to do than just smirk and look angry all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I love that she kind of emotes about desperation and, you know, your loved one is dead or potentially dying. But then, and this is, I think Duncan on Chani and her being kind of a subservient. Oh, also, I think that's a 1984 Lynch movie problem. Because if you read the book, she's much more capable and much more competent than that. Mm-hmm. Like, she's a capable fighter. I know, I remember you talked about that scene where someone wanted to come and challenge Muad'Dib, and she just puts him down. I'm like, hey, if they can't if they can't beat me, they possibly can't beat you either. Right. Like, she's a competent fighter. She's a Sayyadina, so she's, you know, religious education. She knows the rites. She's soft with Paul when they're in kind of private, but she's, in this scene specifically, Jessica calls on her. She comes around. They have that awkwardness with the formalities. But after that, Jessica, and this is true in the 2000 miniseries as well, she like confesses that she has no idea what to do. Like, she's desperate because she doesn't know what's going on with her son. And like, Chani, help me. And Chani isn't breaking down about, oh, okay, he's not dead. He's potentially dying. She's like, okay, let's try to figure out what's wrong and let's try to solve it. She goes into problem-solving mode like that.
Yep.
So she's super competent. And so that's why, like, my favorite Chani adaptation is still the sci-fi miniseries. And shout out to Barbora Kudaitova, because she definitely represented that well.
Yeah.
We have talked many times on this show about how the deeper we get into Dune Part 2, at least for myself, the more I don't like it, and the more that I'm, you know, really realizing that sci-fi miniseries had it probably the best.
Yeah.
Close to the source material.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all.
That said, Part 2, I still love.
Yeah.
I still think it's a fantastic movie. But in terms of, like, accuracy and, you know, staying true to everything, it's not the best.
I don't even mind the changes, to be honest. Like, I don't mind the change. I didn't, like, I thought the idea of young people thinking something different than the older generation, I thought that was a great idea. The problem is that I feel like it was implemented without, or maybe they had a, you know, thought put into what's going to happen down the line, but definitely in this scene, it kind of comes crashing down.
Yeah.
Like, you made certain changes to characters, you made certain changes to culture, which I think are really good and kind of modern audiences would be more receptive to it. But then because of those changes, things down the line make less sense.
Mm-hmm. It almost becomes a different story.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe it's the same story, but you're looking at it from a different perspective now, which is, I think, has been admitted by Denis Villeneuve numerous times, is that, yeah, he's telling his interpretation or his adaptation of the story, which is totally fine.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the big things, we've talked about a lot of big things that are missing, but, you know, since our last time recording, you know, peek behind the curtain, it's been 2 weeks. One of the things, just like in the process of taking notes and thinking on it and everything, not including Chani's significance as a Sayyadina is also like a pretty big misstep.
And I think it'll come into focus in the next minutes as well.
Yeah. Well, not only in the next minutes, but also just in Messiah.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that's...
You mean Dune Part 3.
Sorry. Yes, Dune Part 3. where, you know, we're going to see the extent that she's going to go to, you know, want to have a family and everything. And it's not going to be great.
So I'm going to get us back on track with a minute because we got a number of seconds to go through in this minute. I think we're about 10 seconds into the minute.
Something like that. Yeah.
So Stilgar, in Chakopsa, says, because he is the one, the Lisan al Ghaib should find his way to where no man has ever been. Which is a clunky sentence. A clunky sentence in English. It sounds great in Chakopsa. and to this, Chani just goes, you're insane. I feel like she's been wanting to say that this entire movie to him.
Yep.
And it is finally just boiled over. And she gets to say, you are insane.
One thing that I love about, like, Stilgar's line there and everything is because, like, he is in his, like, this is the moment for Stilgar. Mm-hmm. He's almost kind of, like, stuttering some of the words that he's saying. Mm-hmm. Like that is the extent of his fervor in this moment and, like, the emotional toll that this moment is taking on him and everything. And it's just, like, one of those very small little details that gets put into a movie that you don't really notice until, like, you really pay attention, and then it's like, oh shit, like, this is actually cool as fuck.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Chesica begins to remind Chani against all of her protests that, you know, she's a part of this prophecy and Paul needs her help to fight the poison.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to say is when Stilgar says that because he's the one, I felt like, and like the whole sentence as well, I felt like they merged two things together from the book.
Mm.
One was the kind of holy trance that we already mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one was an epigraph, an Irulan epigraph from one of the chapters around this, maybe exactly this chapter, which ends with, thus was the prophecy made true that the Lisan al-Ghaib might be both dead and alive.
Ah, okay.
So I feel like that's something that they're trying to put in, because that's definitely a canonically correct kind of legend or myth mm-hmm. or about the Lisan al-Ghaib. What I was kind of more put off by is how he finishes the sentence saying, to where no man has ever been. Because I felt like that's less of a Fremen thing and more a Bene Gesserit thing.
Yes. Okay. So here we're getting into another beef that I have with this scene. How many people know, and how much do they know about the inner machinations of the Bene Gesserit? Because they seem to have just an encyclopedic knowledge of what they're doing and kind of what they're here to do, even though it was teed up to be such a secretive thing.
The super secret shadow sisterhood that suddenly has all of their, like, secrets, you know, out there.
It's just, I don't know. The right people know the right things at the right time.
I'm going to devil's advocate this line here, because I think where Stilgar is approaching this from is, no man has ever taken the water of life and lived.
Sure.
Okay, because my next question would have been, what's this place that no man has ever been?
Yeah, I mean, that, and that is something that all Fremen would know.
Yeah.
They're not, I don't think Stilgar is talking about that place that they dare not look.
Certainly okay. Sounds like it.
You will find me staring back, or whatever yeah. The line was.
Yeah. This also could be just from the lens that, you know, we have personally of just knowing all this other stuff and
oh yeah, absolutely,
and comparing all of it. But I get what you're saying about
but the wider audience would not know about. Yeah. There is a place that you dare not look, you know.
Yeah,
that whole conversation that Paul has with
Dune Prophecy hasn't been released yet when this came out. So how would they know?
It's not even prophecy though. Like it's just like, who was it? Paul and Moheim having that conversation about how she'll find him staring back.
Yeah,
that's at the very end, yeah. I think. Yeah. But yes, but this is like it's rhyming to a discussion that Paul and Moheim had in the very beginning of the book, where kind of Moheim is telling him about the truth-sayer drug and how through the drug and with the drug, the Bene Gesserit are able to kind of go back, but only look in the memories of the female line, and they're mm-hmm. kind of that they're terrified to look into the male line.
Right. Yeah. If that is the context, Stilgar knows way too much. if it's not, then he's just saying words right now.
I firmly believe it's in the context of no man has ever lived after taking the water of life.
Yeah, I can get behind that.
But in that case, there's such a good line in the book mm-hmm. about, you know, the Lisa Nagaib might be both dead and alive. Because yep. he didn't die. Jessica confirms that he didn't die. So, and I feel like that's a really cool line from Herbert.
Yeah.
But okay.
I think of all the things to get hung up on, this is probably not the one.
Yeah.
There's much bigger things that we can talk about.
If only there was some other figure that was both dead and alive that we could yes. compare this against. Yep.
I haven't read that book yet.
Oh, okay.
So when Jessica steps in and says, "Hey, you need to help, you know, fight this help him fight this poison," Chani just directs her anger now towards Jessica, and just basically is like, "You did this to him. You fix it. He's your son. Fix it yourself."
Yep.
I don't have the exact quote, but I think that's like 80% correct.
That's yeah. That's basically the crux of what she gets at. Yeah.
Exactly. And just lots of anger.
Would that have been your reaction? You're like your significant other or like the love of your life is dying on the floor. Yeah. And some manipulative bitch is trying to tell you to do something. And your reaction is, no, I won't. Why?
It wouldn't have been my reaction in the moment because I would have switched to problem solving mode.
I know.
Immediately. But maybe afterwards out in the hall, I would have been like, you should have fixed this. You know, in the debrief.
But you know what
later,
I mean? Like I felt like it's so weird that she's visibly distraught. She's desperate. Her hands are shaking. And her reaction isn't, what do I need to do? Jesus, just let's fix this because this is horrible. I don't want him to die. Her reaction is, no, you do it.
And it just gets worse because she, you know, Jessica again says that you may not believe in the prophecy, but you're part of it. And Chani then just continues on her attack with the, you know, you're the poison, you and your lies.
Yeah.
Which is, this is so unproductive. I think you're absolutely right. This is not helping in any way. Makes a good movie conversation, but mm-hmm. it's not advancing them towards a resolution at all. And then this is the mental gymnastics, or this is where I want to understand the mental gymnastics that Chani is going through right now, because she then looks at Paul and goes, why would you do this? So it's like, it's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault.
Why'd you do it?
Stop hitting yourself. Stop hitting yourself.
Pretty much.
It's just, she's having such an explosive moment. Everyone is catching shrapnel from this.
Yeah. Mm. But then I think Chani catches the biggest piece because Jessica immediately, with the voice, in a time where it actually kind of makes sense for Jessica to use the voice, says, do it.
Yes.
And then we get
do it.
Another fat 808 drop.
yeah.
Maybe not one as fat. Actually,
it was pretty good. It's still pretty good.
I don't know if there was one now that I'm thinking about it, because it turns more into like a haunting series of like rapid string sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And Chani like enters this kind of trance-like state that we've seen with other people with, you know, that have been affected by the voice in the movies enter. And she just like slowly rises up perfectly straight over Paul, still on her knees though. And, you know, the pilgrims in the background all begin to, you know, stand, and the camera cuts to Stilgar, who's just like, he shall come back from the dead with desert spring tears. And our minute ends with Chani winding up to say something, but we don't mm-hmm. have that translation yet on screen. So as we've talked about in previous episodes, unless the Chekovs is on screen,
yep.
we don't know what she's going to say.
That's right. Now, before we get too far away from it, I want to give the writers a big round of applause here for an appropriate use of the voice. this one made sense, and it is it was a good one. Martin, I wanted to bring to you a question about something that we talked about a number of weeks ago at this point, but it's about Jessica's very crude ability to use the voice compared to Margot Fenring's very slick ability to use their voice.
In fairness, Geis Helen Moheim is more on the crude side, but she mm-hmm. does, at least in the very early parts of part one, when she and Paul are first introduced, still has a little bit of that, like, more suave.
Yeah.
But definitely, you know, is more of a brute hammer with it as mm-hmm. well. So,
yeah.
Kind of my read was, I think, similar to, I think John said that. It almost feels like she's, whenever she's kind of lashing out emotionally, that's when kind of voice creeps in. Even like when she was saying, you might not believe in the prophecy, but you're a part of it. You're a part of it had like a subtle hint of the voice. Very, like, it's not actual voice, but it's like there's a raspiness, like definitely something like a sound effects was added to that second half of the sentence. And again, I feel like it's when she's almost like animalistic, so like a growl when she's emotionally charged and she kind of can't contain it. And like my headcanon is that it's related to Alia and that whole relationship. And, you know, we talked about this on Blue Sky. I had the same theory that Alia is either mind-controlling her sometimes, has a mommy meat puppet, or like there's some kind of control goes in. So in my mind, not this do it, but the previous instances in the last couple of minutes were kind of the vocal equivalent of baring her teeth. If you imagine like an almost wild animal that can't contain itself. That was kind of my read on this. I don't like, from a lore perspective, I don't think there's any, anything like this going on in the first place. But even if there was, like, there's no explanation that goes with it. So my headcanon is that just she's pumped.
Yeah. And they've changed the nature of the voice so much for the movies. It's almost not worth comparing them, comparing the two, because they're very different. I mean, the voice in the movie is a sledgehammer. The voice in the books is like a scalpel, you know.
Unless you're Margot Fenring.
True enough. No, that was delicately and excellently done. But like, I know it was nitpicky at the beginning of the minute, but like, my biggest kind of beef with this minute is this: do it. Like, how is this a voice command at all? Like, do what? Like, is there like telepathically she just transferred the information that Chani needs to do? Like, do what? Because this kind of sledgehammer, I remember when Prophecy came out and Valia Harkonnen was using voice left and right, like many Redditors were saying that, you know, if they had this kind of almost Star Wars force power to force people to do stuff with their voice, whenever they would get into a fight, they would just like, shit yourself. And then the fight's over. Like, what's going on? So it's just so like, do what?
Yeah.
What is the do it? Why is this a command at all?
I'm glad she didn't interpret it the wrong way.
Unless it's, you know, Chani yeah. instinctively knows what she has to do, but just is refusing to do it. But like, we don't. But as a movie viewer, and you know, you're not really given any indication that Chani knows what the fuck is going on, because literally seconds ago, Chani's like, "What the fuck happened? Why did you do this?" Like,
if I can devil's advocate this one, because I can kind of explain this away. Is like a couple of seconds ago when Jessica was saying, like, you might not believe in the prophecy, but you're still a part of it. So in my mind, that's an implication of Chani knowing the appropriate steps from the prophecy. So when Jessica says do it, she basically says do what's in the prophecy, like remember what you learned in Fremen school and just do that. It's weak and it's janky AF, but like that's the best I can come up with, because otherwise it's just a do what.
All the what you're saying, so all the things that are in prophecy are very specific. You know, do this, take out your blade, cut your throat, all this kind of stuff.
Even
earlier in part one, when Jessica uses the voice, it's always very specific directions.
Yeah,
you know, give me the water, or in the helicopter, the ornithopter.
Untie me.
So, yeah, a little vague, but maybe she's
untie
speaking to
her
the heart.
Gag, kill him, cut the rope, give me the knife.
Find them.
Yeah.
Bring them here, whatever she says to the guy in the desert.
More salt, please.
Yeah, exactly.
Drink your Ovaltine.
All right, cool. Any other notes on this minute?
One last small note. The minute ends with Stilgar saying, "He shall come back from the dead with desert spring tears." And I couldn't remember if you already talked about this, but desert spring is Chani's kind of siege name.
Yeah, Sihaya.
So we call her, exactly, Sihaya is Fremen for the desert spring time. That's why it's desert spring tears, because it's the tears of Chani, whose siege name is Sihaya, which means desert spring.
Yeah. We talked about the name when she told Paul out in the desert, and he's like, "Oh, I love that name." And she goes,
"Oh yeah,
I hate that name." And he goes, "Oh, I hate it too. Yeah, I hate it too."
No, overall, the only thing from this minute, and I think it kind of culminated from previous minutes last week, is, or maybe even 2 weeks ago when you were talking about archetypes, that some of the characters like Stilgar are becoming archetypes. And I feel like it's gotten worse to the point where people don't really have agency anymore. So like, why did Paul take the Water of Life, for example? Because a minute or two ago, some weird-ass noises in his head said, "Blizzard's Hadorak, you need to drink the..." Like, he didn't make a choice. He didn't make a decision there, right? And that kind of bugs me, because in the book, there's a very logical reason. And you talked about this a couple of weeks back, a scene that was never in the movies, when Gurney thinks that Jessica was the traitor. So Gurney tries to kill her. And Paul's like, "I've never seen that. I didn't have a vision about that. I'm limited by what I see. So I need to either get next level or die trying." And that's his reason. And that's, I feel like, a good enough reason. While here, DJ Jamis is saying to him, "Oh, a hunter needs to go, you know, to high ground." Like,
never his friend.
Exactly. Like, is that a good enough reason for you to try to risk your life?
Yeah.
And same here with Chani. She doesn't participate at all. She just gets yelled at by Jessica to do it. And I feel like that's such a pity that her agency is now taken away. It just, I don't know. It feels messy, and it feels messy because of decisions that they made in the movie, and maybe even in part one.
It could be. I mean, I know I've said this before, but it really feels like they're just, you know, rushing towards the end here. It's the writing, it's getting a little, I'll say a little more than a little sloppy. And it's just, we're trying to get to the fight at the end. That's really kind of where this is, just a stopover before we can get to that big fight scene.
And it shouldn't be, because I feel like this is the pivotal moment of the movie. Like, this is you know, die or try or die.
If only they could have split this up into three, I don't know, hour and a half long parts to do a better job of explaining the story.
Maybe what one day they'll get that. What an original idea.
It's like a sci-fi original idea. All right, cool. Well, let's get back here tomorrow and continue this tense scene.
Yeah, we have a lot more to talk about this week. Martin, before we go, since this is your first episode with us this week, tell the people where they can find you online. Because obviously we've talked about Blue Sky and how we, you know, talk over there and everything. But I know that you have a lot more really cool Dune content on the internet for other people too.
Indeed I do. If anyone is or wants to be as big of a nerd as the three of us, they should visit DuneNavigator.com, where I publish a weekly newsletter diving into Frank Herbert's Dune. So the core canon, the Dune encyclopedia, and also the expanded universe. I come up with questions, and then I try to do kind of research articles about lore things. One of my favorite articles from the last couple of weeks was the canonically correct ages of all the characters, and that's actually a free article that's not paywalled, and I really love what I found, because some of these characters you wouldn't think they're as old as they are. So DuneNavigator.com, and thank you that I could plug this.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I've read almost every single one of them. They're awesome. I was just reading up on, I think as of this recording, the latest one was the Animals of Dune.
Yeah, the Weird Animals of Dune.
Yep, and that was a real fun read. It was great.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It is well worth the few bucks that you'd spend to get behind that paywall. I highly recommend everyone do it.
Yeah. Martin's got fantastic content, and he makes us look like casuals, which we are, let's be real.
Not at all.
Well, in the meantime, you can find the Dune Minute online. On Blue Sky, we are at DuneMinute.com, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. We will be back tomorrow with another episode as we continue our journey through Chani doing it, I guess. We'll see y'all tomorrow.
All right, see ya.
Bye.